think we have quorum. So this next session, if you've taken a look at the notes, is probably the longest session that we have. We're going to buzz through a few things, hopefully, and try to spend most of the time on what will hopefully be the most useful things for you guys, which will be more of the tools. Maybe more than... More so than, proteins, I think a lot of people have a pretty basic understanding of DNA structure. I mean, it's taught in high schools most of the times, and maybe if you're not thinking about, you know, the three-dimensional or the even the secondary structure of DNA or RNA, some of the concepts are fairly similar to what we've already covered in terms of protein structure. And so, you know, we're going to be pretty quick moving through some of this stuff. Probably if I ever extend this into a longer session, I would probably split this whole session up into two, just like we had with DNA or with protein. So we'd have a protein or a DNA structure and then a DNA tools session. But we're going to try to cram it all into one and see how that works. Actually, I think the first year I taught this, when it was just like two people, we did make this into two separate sessions, but I've crammed it back into this one. So, you know, as again, we're going to try to move quickly. DNA is another biological polymer. In this case, the backbone is not so much made of peptide bonds, but of phosphodiester bonds, and it's used to carry the genetic material, transfer the genetic material from one generation to the next, or use it in transcribing and making proteins. And so there'll be some slides here on the central dogma, either in this talk or in the next one, or in tomorrow, or yeah, the talk on Pymol. But this is genetic information, basically. And just because it's genetic information doesn't mean it has to be found in the nucleus. Obviously, prokaryotes don't have a nucleus, so it's just found in the cytoplasm there. But in eukaryotes, there's going to be, you know, DNA in the mitochondria. If you're talking about plants, it's going to be found in the chloroplasts as well. And so there's various types of DNA that you can be looking at. The structure of DNA, as we've potentially talked about before, or you know, you've seen before, is similarly modular. So whereas the protein has a backbone, a DNA molecule would have a backbone as well. And so this region would represent the DNA backbone. It's made of a sugar. Ribose sugar, a phosphate, which can then form bonds to other ribose sugar, and then, you know, in the protein we had side chains. In DNAs we have a base. Whether this is DNA or RNA depends on whether this 2' position has an alcohol. And so if it's deoxy ribonucleic acid, this 2' position is going to just be a proton. If it's ribonucleic acid, then this ribose is just going to have the standard ribose structure, which has an OH there. The naming convention, again, we're not going to be too rigorous or rigid on this, but if you're in a molecular biology, or if you're in a real hardcore DNA lab, they're going to be more rigid. You know, we make the distinction between this base and nucleosides are generally the sugar and the base, and then a nucleotide includes the sugar, at least one phosphate, and the base. And so if you're thinking about doing PCR and you order nucleotide triphosphates, DNTPs, this is what you'd be ordering with three phosphates on the end. You wouldn't order nucleoside triphosphates. That wouldn't make any sense. The naming convention is there. It's a vocabulary. It's a convention that if you're in the lab and you're doing this a lot, you're likely going to have to learn. Just like with proteins, the bases themselves have different chemical features. We basically have five bases that we can think about. In DNA, we would have A, G, or adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. In RNA, we would have uracil instead of thymine. But you can see each of these bases, whether they're bicyclic rings based on this purine structure or monocyclic rings based on the pyrimidine, has different hydrogen bond donors and acceptors. And this is important not only for the Watson-Crick base pairing, but any other type of base pairing. So if you have reverse Hoechstein base pairing, the hydrogen bond donors and acceptors are really what make the structure of DNA work the way it does. There's no charged groups, and by and large, all of the bases look pretty much the same. I mean, yeah, you move chemical groups around, but it makes sense that nucleic acids generally don't catalyze interesting reactions like photoreceptors, right? So there are cases where nucleic acids can catalyze reactions, and those are interesting. There's no way you could have life as we know it just using these four bases. There's just not enough chemical diversity amongst the bases themselves. Here's some naming, some nomenclature. Again, I'm assuming a lot of this is review. But if you're thinking about, what's the difference between naming a nucleoside versus a nucleotide, again, you could say adenosine, which would, again, have the sugar in the base. You could say adenylate, which would have the phosphate. You could also say adenosine triphosphate, which would be obviously the sugar of the base plus the phosphate, and that would be fine. So that's all there for you and for your reference. Again, we know that we can put these together and make long chains out of them. We have a polymerase, which can basically attach one to the next, making things in the 5' to 3', and that's generally, we talked about in proteins, we have the convention where if we give somebody a sequence, it starts at the N-terminus and ends at the N and the C-terminus. DNA has the same kind of thing. So all of these sugar carbons are labeled, and so generally the 5' phosphate gives the end of this one. And the 3' hydroxy group gives the alternative end. But just like in proteins, you don't have to see what the structure is to know the orientation of the DNA. You can read it off 5' to 3', even if your instructor has hidden this side and there's no direct phosphate there. It's a matter of looking at the order of how the chains are built up. And if you want to be super clear, then the way you do it is you express the 5', and then you give the names of the bases, and then you give the 3'. So this is sort of like our primary structure nomenclature for proteins. The main difference here between a DNA, deoxy, and RNA, again, is this presence of this 2' hydroxy group. The general reason that you don't see, some viruses do, but most organisms use DNA as their genetic material. And one of the reasons I like this figure is that this sort of shows you why. If you can imagine that this OH has some electrons and whatnot, and this oxygen here also has some electrons, you can sort of see that, there might be some room for a nucleophilic attack to go on there. And again, RNA generally is much less stable than DNA is. It's extremely unstable in the lab. Not only are there lots of RNases or molecules that chew up RNA around, But you know, the backbone itself is intrinsically less stable than DNA, which lacks that OH group. And so RNA is great. It can actually do some really interesting chemistry that's more difficult for DNA to do. On the other hand, it's also less stable, and it's going to be around for a lot less time in a cell. We know that Watson-Crick base pairing happens. Here's some hydrogen bonding patterns. Again, if this were a traditional biochem class, you'd probably have to memorize these. And it forms, again, a nice double helical structure that you guys have probably been seeing since you were 5 or 6. So this isn't new at this point, but it does show you how these hydrogen bonding in the base pairs themselves, and then you could have uracil here, you just lop off that methyl group. But in the base pairs themselves, they form hydrogen bonds. A's and T's generally have two hydrogen bonds between the bases, and then G's and C's have three. And this leads to you have differences in stability. So once we get into some of the tools, and we think about talking about how much energy does it take to melt this double helical structure, sequences with lots of G's and C's, because of these additional hydrogen bonds, are going to be harder to melt than sequences with lots of A's and T's. And so that's, even now you can see some of the energetics coming in. And so one of the very simple things is this idea of a reverse complement, right? So we have this concept where A's and T's and G's and C's are specified. And so if I give you the primary structure or the sequence of one strand of DNA, you guys, we should be able to calculate the Watson-Crick base paired strand that complements that DNA. Just recognizing the fact that A and T complement each other and G and C. And so, in this particular case, we can do the calculation. And so for our example here, if we have, this sequence AU, CCGCCTT, and we assume that that's in the normal convention, 5 prime to 3 prime. AUCCGCCTT. Right, the way we would do this is we would say, okay, well, A hybridizes with T, or if we want to do, this is obviously U, so this is RNA. So A hybridizes with uracil and vice versa. C's and G's are the same. And that's interesting. Maybe that's a typo. Now, let's assume that I did this right and was consistent in my numbering. And so now we would have this, and then this would be the reverse complement. And again, now if this is 5 prime, 3 prime, then that means this would be 3 prime, 5 prime. And so if I were telling a colleague via email, for example, what's the reverse complement, I would probably reverse this and give it in this traditional notation. And in which case, that would be A, G, G, C, C, G, G, A, U.
We've already introduced a mutation.
Really?
Yep. You have an extra C.
Oh, yeah, because there's one. Okay. Yeah. See? I don't have the 3 prime 5 prime mix of nuclease activity that DNA polymerase does. So there you go. So if you were just being fast and loose, you could probably just email that and give them the actual orientation, which would be fine. You could just say, okay, remember this starts with 3 prime. But already here you can see, for this very simple, nine base sequence, I've already introduced a mutation, right? So doing this by hand is tedious and annoying, and it's error prone as well. And so here is where we can start thinking about how we might take advantage of computers to make some of this more robust
and less error prone. A computer might make an error every once every couple hundred years, whereas for something like this, I can make an error within 9 bases. So
what we see is that, okay, this is stuff that we can do. It's reasonable, and it's not difficult. It's just, you know, that kind of work is often better suited for a computer to do. We can start thinking about structure in DNA. So just like we showed you the double helical structure, but there's actually a lot more complexity when we think about the possible structures of DNA. So you know, the great thing about proteins is that you have that delocalization in the backbone. That means that for every amino acid, you essentially only have 2 degrees of freedom, phi and psi. But if you think about the backbone in DNA, there's all sorts of degrees of freedom that can crop up. And this sort of gives you the notation, and again, IUPAC is all over this, right? So you can see that, you know, there's an alpha, beta, gamma, angle, delta, epsilon. I don't know my Greek alphabet to know what that is. That may be a C.
Zeta,
okay. Nus, a chi. So there's all sorts of you know, angles. So the thinking that there's going to be a nice simple Ramachandran plot for DNA, probably not going to happen. I have a friend who actually worked on this as their graduate thesis. You can actually do pretty well. You know, it's not a simple two-dimensional plot, but if you want to search for Venkatesh Murthy, and he did a lot of work on this, you know, trying to quantify the backbone. It's interesting that a lot of the people who work on these types of things end up being Indian. I don't know if there's probably a history there, but Venk is now a radiologist, and so he's sort of stepped out of RNA research. So obviously the backbone has lots of complexity. You also have complexity within the ring itself, right? And so if you think about that ring, I mean, you know, if you take an organic and you remember that if you have a 6-membered ring, you can often form the chair and the boat forms. With a 5-membered ring, you can't quite do that, but they have the similar types of classifications that can work here. And what we do is we basically try to place the 1-0, the C1, the O4, and the C4 prime in a flat plane. And then we basically ask ourselves, what's happening to the 2 prime and the 3 prime carbon? And if one of those particular atoms is above the plane, then that's called endo. If the other atom is below the plane, that's called exo. And so this is called sugar pucker. And you can see that there's basically 4 combinations of sugar pucker here. You know, C2 prime endo, C3 prime exo, I believe, are the 2 most popular. But this simplifies to a certain extent, you know, at least the sugar torsion angles in that sugar ring. Okay, so yeah, we've already talked about this a little bit, but nucleic acid primary structure is very similar to proteins. You just list the sequence, and if you want, you can put these deoxy A's, deoxy G's, but most often it's just convention. I'm either talking about DNA, and you can read it from context, or if I want to make, you know, a clear indication, hey, here's T's, so that's clearly DNA, here's U's, that's clearly RNA. But you can often, you know, don't have to do this whole rigmarole. Similarly, you don't often have to give the 5' or 3'. It's assumed. So here's where we can think of our bioinformatics databases using characters as a way to sort of assess sequence composition and properties. Secondary structure is for a nucleic acid a little bit different than what we would have for a protein. So remember, for a protein, it corresponds to backbone hydrogen bonding. Secondary structure generally for a nucleic acid corresponds to the hydrogen bonding of the base pairs, right? And so a traditional Watson-Crick type base pairing would have, you know, this kind of a secondary structure where it's just lined up with one another. But you can imagine that, okay, well, if this is hydrogen bonded, this hydrogen bonded, these aren't, Well, then this is forming like a hairpin loop. So it's the chain starts in going this direction, 5', 3', and then it comes out and it reverses direction through that loop. You know, this is generally more prone or flexible in RNA. Again, that additional oxygen gives RNA a little bit more hydrogen bonding flexibility, and it makes it a little bit more flexible as far as forming more complicated structures like what I've shown here. But I'm not an RNA guy. I mean, there are people who devote their entire life to RNA. I'm not one of them. But there's all sorts of representations of what RNA can do as far as the structures it can form. Anything from very simple hairpin loops to things like tRNAs where there's multiple loops to these pseudo-knots where they basically have things that look like there's actually a knot forming, but if you break it down to the secondary structure, you just see that it's a whole bunch of base pairs with sort of unique base pairing properties. So, in that sense, secondary structure in nucleic acids is base pairing motifs. And then, of course, you can have tertiary structure as well. Here's an example of three forms of DNA. And in all cases, the base pairing is the same. You know, you have these base pairs between different bases, but depending on the conformation of the backbone itself, or the phosphodiester backbone, you can either have this A form, which is more condensed, B form, which is our traditional sort of form, and that's what you mostly think of when you think of DNA structure, to Z form, where now you've sort of actually unwound the DNA and you sort of flipped it so that it's now a left-handed type of a helix. You can look at the structure of the positions of the atoms. In this representation, you can see that there's two grooves. There's a major groove here, where there's lots of space to come in and access the sequence. There's a minor groove here, where the structure is more constrained. And so you start to see features of the three-dimensional structure of DNA that may not be evident just by thinking about the two-dimensional base pairing. And this is some basic torsion angles on average that people have characterized. The structure database for nucleic acid structures is not nearly as intense or large as proteins. And in fact, that was another thing that Venk worked on was RNA base. And I believe we finally retired RNA base when we moved that lab's web server here to Mississippi State. But for probably about a decade, it would just go and collect RNA structures, and now I think everything is pretty much stored in the protein data bank alongside protein structures. But not necessarily so easy as saying minus 60, minus 40 is an alpha helix. A lot more complexity going on here. And then we can have quaternary structure. So this is, I think, two chains coming together. This is the group 1 catalytic intron, and so we highlighted, or you mentioned a few minutes ago, that RNA can be catalytic. Most of the catalysis that RNA carries out is backbone cleavage. So, but this is a case where, if you have a transcript, and that transcript contains introns and exons, and the RNA has the appropriate structure, it can actually cleave itself, so that those introns are removed during translation translation. So, this is the structure of the group 1A catalytic intron. You can see it's obviously very complicated, but I'm not an RNA guy, so I'm not going to be able to tell you where all the kissing loops and hairpins and what all those things look like. But I think the point here is that you tend to simplify, or you tend to assume that nucleic acids can't really do the same kind of things that proteins can, And to a certain extent, that's true. I mean, they don't have the same kind of charge groups and whatnot, but they can still be incredibly diverse in their function and structure. And so that's good to remember as we start to think about some of these RNA and DNA databases. Okay, so let's have a couple minutes here where you guys can sort of chat, and if you want to discuss, what are the differences that we just talked about, what are the similarities. This is mostly just a quick review, I think. Okay, what did you guys come up with?
You said the DNA backbone is more stable and a similarity is, what did you say?
Sequencing? They're both polymers.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so they're similar polymers. The stability thing is a good point. I mean, my students often wonder, I mean, well, maybe not often, but sometimes they say, well, do I need to freeze my DNA at minus 80? And to which I say, well, do you need to freeze your own DNA at minus 80 for it to be particularly stable? And the answer is no. I mean, maybe you don't want to leave your stuff sitting on the bench. But DNA is stable for many, many years. We've come back and taken DNA samples that were accidentally left on the bench, and they can transform just fine. Provided that they're not exposed to, nucleases and other things that might chop up DNA. So the stability, I think, is a great point. Of all of the sort of biological molecules, DNA is by far the most stable in the sense that it will be around for the longest. We often think about Jurassic Park, which I know is a work of fiction, but there's some elements of truth. I mean, you can extract short DNA sequences from ancient material and get information. Now, you can't get entire genomes, at least not yet, but that's certainly been done, meaning that DNA is stable enough that even after, thousands or millions of years, you can still find some of it. So good thing to remember. What were you guys talking about?
So we had touched on stability, but the other thing is that nucleic acid. So I think I also want to go back to stability because it's more stable, is you can get a lot more information in the DNA. You have fewer pieces but at the same time, you're not trying to necessarily build a structure with a function other than carry information in the sequence of things.
Yeah, no, DNA is sort of uniquely optimized to be an information carrier. The fact that you can regenerate one sequence from another or vice versa is something that you can't do with proteins. So that I think the information content is an intriguing aspect of DNA as well. Okay, so this next section I think is probably the section that we're going to basically zip through the quickest. You know, we're a bit, mostly because it's review, it's not terribly relevant, so I want to make sure we get to some of the more interesting stuff at the end. But cells are, they have parts. Bacterial cells and animal cells differ a little bit. It's very crowded in the cell. And then, you know, we have this concept of central dogma, which, you know, we use the DNA as information carrier, but somehow we have to get to functional, you know, actor. And so the way that we do that is through the central dogma, where, you know, first DNA is transcribed to RNA, you know, in a 5'3' direction, but the DNA has to be read in the opposite direction. And then RNA is translated into protein at the ribosome. And so this is usually by polymerases. This is done by the ribosome. But the nice thing about the way the convention has developed is that if you just read your DNA in the traditional 5'3' way, so if somebody sends you a DNA sequence, you know, that lets you determine the codons that are used for protein or peptide synthesis. And, you know, we have the genetic code, which is the list of all the codons. This is the standard genetic code. And so you can see that, again, UUU, or again, if your colleague has just sent you DNA, TTT gives you phenylalanine. Some of those you know, genetic codes are reserved. So we have AUG, which is our start codon. That should be somewhere on here. Yeah, so we read first A, second U, so there we go. It's also methionine. And then we have three stop codons, which, again, I like this table because it gives the names. Oftentimes, you guys don't care, but, you know, if somebody says, oh, they have a bacterial strain that's an opal suppressor, that means that every once in a while, it's going to read through an opal and put an alternative amino acid there. So that's why they have names, is because sometimes those tRNAs aren't, you know, they can mutate too. And sometimes it's very useful to have a somewhat sloppy stop codon. But those are called opal, amber, and ochre. And they just have names like, you know, they have sequences like the rest of them. Clearly, if you're just given a sequence and you're not told how it works, like if you have a big sequence that you've just extracted from somebody's genome, there's obviously three ways to look at this. If you start here and you translate ACT, or ACU would be the transcript, but ACT, that would give you threonine, but CTT would give you leucine, or TTA would also give you leucine. So you can imagine that depending on where I start reading, I end up with a different translation of the DNA. And that's called reading frames. We can imagine that there are three reading frames in the forward direction, but then there would be another three reading frames in the reverse direction. So if we just didn't have no idea which way the polymerase or the ribosome was reading, and I just gave you a sequence that you might get from a sequencing facility, you would have to consider the forward reading frames, there's three of them, and the reverse reading frames. And as we look at the utilities to do this, because again, you could do this, you could go back and arduously, you know, look through the table and translate things on your own. But it's much more efficient to have a computer do it. And a computer will have to go through and, you know, read through each of the three reading frames in the forward direction, compute the reverse complement, and then read through the reading frames in the reverse direction. So that would give you six total frames to look at. Oftentimes, you know whether it's going to be forward or reverse.
But sometimes you don't. And so you have to sort of know what, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out. You've got to sort of know what you're dealing with to make a sensible answer. Okay, I'm gonna skip this. The answer is clearly no, but the fact is it often works. And so this figure back here is a good one to remember. This was done by David Goodsell, probably right when I was starting graduate school, early 2000s, these kinds of figures became popular. And the question is, you know, each one of these purple things is a ribosome. You can see that there's a, and then this, you know, yellow stuff is genetic material, chromatin, histones, things like that. You know, there's a lot going on in the cell. It's not aqueous media by a long shot. And so one of the questions is this kind of affect the biophysics? If we measure an enzyme kinetic rate, is that any more realistic in this kind of a cellular environment? You know, the research seems to be saying that, yes, there are perturbations. It's not exactly the same working in aqueous media as it is working in a crowded environment. But for many reactions, things do seem to work, and the perturbations are fairly small. So that's kind of cool. And it does make it easier to do biochemistry if we don't have to work with this all the time. Okay, so biochemistry research flowchart. Again, this is sort of an aside. Oftentimes, but this is sort of how we would frame a lot of the tools that we're working out. And you can see where the bioinformatics tools that we're learning about fit into the whole process. So generally, we choose a system. If there's protein available, then maybe we can just go to the source. This is how the early biochemists did it. They wanted to study horse hemoglobin. So they would go down to the local, maybe not the butcher shop, but if you look at a lot of the original proteins that were crystallized, they were things like spermware myoglobin. Well, John Kendry went out and talked to the whalers and said, hey, can you give me some heart from these whales that you're killing that you're not using? So that's why, you know, why myoglobin was one of the first proteins to be crystallized. So you can, you know, occasionally purify it from source. If not, you can do your literature search, see if somebody else has purified it, but then you can always, you know, do some molecular cloning, see what you can do as far as experiments. If not, you know, you can try another expression system. The expression system that most often gets used in biochemistry groups is a bacterial expression system. And so learning a little bit about bacterial DNA is helpful. The bacterial DNA itself, unlike our DNA, is circular. And so bacteria have circular chromosomes where basically the DNA is connected to itself. When they reproduce, they basically have, you know, they have two replication forks, and that's what reproduces the sequence. But because of this feature, if I put any type of circular plasmid into a bacterium, and it has things like the origin of replication, that means that whenever the bacterium is replicating or duplicating its own DNA, it's also going to duplicate any DNA that I put in there come along for the ride. And so that can be a useful trick, and those are often called plasmids that we can, you know, design or engineer and put into bacteria, and then they can do things for us. And so this is the basis for a lot of biochemical research that goes on. And we can further capitalize on that by using something called the lac operon to get bacteria to express or produce protein for us. So bacteria might not normally produce a protein like human calmodulin, but since they have the same genetic code as the human, if we could somehow introduce the human calmodulin gene into the bacterium using a plasmid, we can maybe trick the bacterium into expressing that particular gene. And so, and the way we do this is the lactose operon. And the lactose operon, you know, is not engineered for calmodulin or really any protein. It's designed as a bacterial survival tool, or it evolved as a bacterial survival tool. And so the bacteria only want to produce, you know, the lactose metabolic stuff, the stuff they can use to metabolize lactose, only if it's needed, right? I mean, there's no point in making proteins that aren't going to actually do anything. And so You know, why metabolize lactose when there's lots of glucose available? Sort of the question here. And so an operon is a set of genes, or ultimately a set of proteins, that are under control of other genes in the cell. And in this particular case, the bacterium only express the genes for metabolizing lactose when glucose is not in readily abundant and lactose is available. And so how does this work? Well, you can imagine that there's a couple of parts that have to be working here. One of those is that the lac operon has some kind of protein around to detect whether or not there's lactose around, whether you need to start expressing these genes. And so some of these are the repressor. And so this LACI, which isn't up here in the list of genes, but it binds at the operator, which is shown here, when there's no lac present or no lactose present. And if it's bound here, that means that RNA polymerase, the thing that would normally make RNA to be translated into protein, if the LACI is bound here, RNA polymerase can't bind at the promoter, and none of these genes gets expressed. Okay? But when lactose is present, then basically what happens, lactose binds to LACI, LACI releases from the operator, and now RNA polymerase can bind here, and all of these genes are expressed. It's polycistronic, if you know what that means. But all these genes can be expressed at once, and we have things like LACZ, which is beta-galactosidase, which is converts lactose and galactose and glucose, and then some of those are used for working with galactose. Glucose is already there, so you can imagine that this is a set of genes under the control of a very simple molecule called lactose. And what we do in genetic engineering applications is we say, okay, well, let's get rid of LACZ, LACY, and LACA, and let's put our gene there. Right? So if I put human calmodulin there and somehow introduce this plasmid into a cell, or this set of genes into a cell, well, then anytime the cell detects lactose, instead of producing LACZ, LACY, and LACA, it's going to produce calmodulin. And so now I can turn on and turn off the expression of calmodulin in my bacterial cell. And one of the traditional ways to do this is using a bacterial expression vector. The original, or some of the earliest to be done, were the PET vectors. And this is sort of the structure of the vector itself, right? So there's ampicillin resistance, meaning that if the bacteria have this vector in it, it's going to be resistant to ampicillin. And this is a great way to select for bacteria that don't have this vector. Because if you grow the bacteria up in media that doesn't contain ampicillin, then those bacteria that don't have this vector are going to die. Ampicillin resistance is expressed constitutively, and so it's always on. LACI, remember, is our promoter. That's always expressed too. And then we have this LACO region, so this is the operator itself. And then this polylinker region, this is where the gene that we want to introduce goes, right? And so what happens is normally at LACI is constitutively expressed. It binds here at LACO and prevents anything in the polylink region from being expressed. But then if we add a small molecule like lactose, now our LAC repressor goes off and this gene can be expressed in here. This origin represents the origin of replication, and so that this vector is going to be replicated along with the bacteria's own chromosome. And so this plasmid is persistent, and it pretty much has all of the tools that we need or that we want for this sort of controlled expression of a particular protein. Okay, now one of the problems is we've talked about using lactose. That's great, but the bacteria has its own lactose metabolism machinery, And so it's going to eventually start using, if we add enough lactose, it's going to start eating it. And so we want to add something that's not going to be eaten by the bacteria. And we, to do that, instead of adding lactose directly, we add this molecule, isopropyl beta-D-thiogalactoside, which looks enough like lactose to convince the lac repressor to let go of the DNA, but can't be hydrolyzed, and so is not used as by the bacteria as a fuel source. And so we can now switch on the protein expression by adding sufficient quantities of IPTG. Okay, and so the practical aspect of this is, you grow your cells up, and we'll see an example of this during the lab notebook section. But you first start growing your cells, they're kind of like, this is a new environment, I'm not used to it. And so they start out by growing very slowly. Eventually the bacteria sort of acclimate to the environment and they reach this constant doubling time. And so they're doubling exponentially. Eventually, and then after a while, they reach steady state. So again, the cells are growing and dying at about the same rate. And so the overall cell population is staying about the same. But eventually the nutrients get exhausted and the cells start to die off. What we want to do is we want to basically add our IPTG during this phase. Because this phase is the phase where the cells are the most healthy. They're growing a lot. And so as I'm producing more of cellular protein, I'll produce a lot more of the protein that I want to express as well. As opposed to producing up here where I'm not really having any net increase in the amount of protein in my sample. And so again, this sort of section is an aside. It's not exactly relevant to computational tools, but since some of you guys might be working with bacterial expression systems, it's nice to know how they work. Typically you're inducing right here at the beginning of the log phase, which if you're measuring the density or the scattering at 600 nanometers, it's about 0.5. And then you basically harvest after a couple of hours once it's reached steady state. But the caveat emptor here is always follow your lab's protocols. Every protein in every cell is a little bit different. And particularly if the protein that you're expressing is toxic to the bacterial cells, this could be very different and you might change things up substantially. But this is sort of the general idea, and then why you do it that way. Okay, so again, that was more of an aside. We're going to keep moving because I want to get to the point where we're doing the tools. So this is sort of where the first session would normally end. Okay, now we're talking about, just like with proteins, you want to talk about how we measure concentrations of DNA. We'll see some websites out there very similar to ProParam, where you can calculate the parameters based on the sequence of DNA. But on the other hand, we just talked about plasmids, and for double-stranded DNA, it's often the case where you're not interested in the overall concentration of the plasmid. Instead, you're interested in the net amount of nucleic acids. And so, instead of representing concentration in terms of micromolar or nanomolar, you might be interested in nanograms of DNA per microliter of solution. And if you're working with double-stranded DNA, and oftentimes you are, if you're doing any kind of biochemistry or molecular biology, you're interested in the nanograms per microliter or micrograms per milliliter. Use the same, and you should work out by factor label that's true. And in that case, the measurement is actually quite simple. DNA, unlike amino acids, every single base in DNA is a great chromophore, right? They all have these nice ring structures, and so they all absorb light fairly readily. But instead of 280 nanometers, DNA absorbs it generally to 260 nanometers. And the extinction coefficient, which is generally true for an average sequence of all double-stranded DNA, is 0.02 inverse micrograms per milliliter per centimeter. And so that's, you know, again, A equals ECL. You still have Beer's Law. This is our extinction coefficient. You could also say that if you... So we have A equals ECL. In a 1 centimeter path length cuvette, the concentration is equal to A over E times L, and L is just 1. And so the concentration in this case in micrograms per mil or mics per mil or nanograms per microliter is basically A, the absorbance, divided by the extinction coefficient. Well, 1 over that is 50. So if you take your absorbance and you multiply it by 50 in a 1 centimeter cuvette, you get your concentration in nanograms per microliter. And so that's a pretty easy number. You don't need to go to a website to figure that one out. And that works generally for any type of plasmid or double-stranded DNA construct. And it's you know, used enough that it's not like you have to like cite anybody for it. It's pretty much just standard lab practice. For DNA and protein, just to give you a feeling for how different these are, again, remember for a protein, maybe one out of every, you know, 20 residues, one out of every 15 residues might be a chromophore. In DNA, every single residue is a chromophore. Every single base is a chromophore. And so because of that, you can often get by measuring much smaller concentrations of DNA. And if you compare this number, you know, and we do a comparison, so we saw GB3 yesterday. You know, the extinction coefficient for DNA is almost an order of magnitude higher than the extinction coefficient for a protein the size of GB3. Meaning that I can measure a concentration 10 times less for DNA and still get the same absorbance. And so oftentimes, you know, this is much more sensitive to the amounts of DNA. And it means that if I have a small DNA contamination in my protein, well then that, you know, it doesn't take much DNA to make a big contribution to the absorbance system. Similarly, if my DNA is very precious, it's nice in the sense that I don't have to use as much to measure a concentration. So there are advantages and disadvantages to this difference. But it all arises from the fact that protein has a very different way in which extinction coefficient is calculated than, you know, double-stranded DNA would. Here's some other traditional values that you can use as estimates. For RNA, it's similar, but it's not quite the same. For single-stranded DNA, you can see it's slightly different as well. These are just rules of thumb. We'll talk about a website that can calculate some of these specifically. For a pure nucleic acid, again, because DNA is so much more sensitive than protein, you would expect that the 260 to 280 ratio should be approximately 1.8 to 2. And so if you're looking at something that's purely DNA, the 260 should be about twice as much as the value of 280. And if you go back here, you can sort of see that. You know, this is pure DNA, and you can see that the 260 is about 0.7, and the 280 ratio is about 0.35. Right. So, and there's other tricks for the vice versa, but I don't know that I have those off the top of my head. That would be probably good to put in the protein talk. Okay, so for single strands, you know, you're working with some primers, or maybe you're interested in studying protein binding to a particular sequence in DNA. You might have 15, 20, 30 bases that you're dealing with. The tool that you sort of go to is on the Integrated DNA Technologies website, so the IDT website. A lot of people will buy their DNA from IDT. I'm no way affiliated with IDT. If they started paying me, that'd be wonderful, but they don't pay me, so I'm not I'm not advocating their company in any way, and actually I think we buy most of our DNA from Midland. But this is sort of the equivalent of ProPair. And they have a lot of software like this, and so we'll start taking a quick look at it. And you know, it's very, very simple. And if you go to the course website or the boot camp website, we have some DNA sequences that you can look at. And so these are probably a little bit big than you would be ordering from either IDT or Midland. But suppose you were just curious about the sequences themselves, we can go look at what that sequence looks like. So you just paste it in, it automatically calculates the number of bases, which is nice. I do recommend the Cavalluzzi-Borer correction, not for any specific reason, but I remember a few years ago actually looking up that paper and thinking, well, it's not the dumbest thing to do. So, but you know, it makes a difference of, again, about 10%, I think. And if this is single-stranded versus duplex, you obviously have to provide that information. But here it's nice because it gives you what it thinks the absorbance coefficient or the extinction coefficient should be at a number of wavelengths. And so even if you maybe have some you know other stuff going on here, you can estimate what it might be at 280 if you're interested in how it is conflating your protein measurement. But you can scroll down here to 260 and almost, not quite, there you go. So you can see that the extinction coefficient, again, this is now in per molar. And so remember, for comparison, GB3 had an extinction coefficient of about 10,000, and even at 205 nanometers, I think it was still about 180,000. Here at 260 nanometers, you have an extinction coefficient of about 1.8 million, right? So it's a big difference, and particularly as you get longer and longer sequences, again, every single residue you add or every single base you add, it's like adding another tryptophan to your protein. So your extinction coefficient goes up quite substantially. I guess we gotta close this. You know, there are websites out there for calculating the reverse complement. This one is very, very simple. What I would call no frills. And tomorrow during the bioinformatics tools or bioinformatics session, we'll actually look at a website that has a lot more of this information integrated and combined together. And so sometimes it's quicker to go and just, you know, Google reverse complement, find a website that does it, and you know, use that. Other times if you're going to be doing it for a while, sometimes it's more convenient to have all the tools in one place, so that you can feed the output from one tool into another and be able to mix and match tools and have them all together. But you know, here's a sample. Again, I think I should still have the other version on my clipboard. So if I convert this into its reverse complement, again, that's exactly what it does. Doesn't do anything more, nothing less. You can also, you know, select it to do other things like just reverse it, or just give it the complement if you've already done the reverse, for example. So those are options that are there for you. Again, very simple calculator there. Saves you a lot of time. As far as thinking about the six-frame translation, here we can go back to the protein analysis system. And this is kind of nice because, you know, again, it's a nice text box. Here it's expecting DNA. Or RNA, I guess, and it assumes that, you know, that you're just giving it genetic material, and it's going to do all six frames of translation, right? So it doesn't know whether it should be reading this forward, whether it should be reading the reverse complement,
And so it's going to do all six frames. And if I hit translate sequence, all those frames are going to be presented. And remember from your genetic code that the start codon represents, you know, AUG or methionine. And so this has all of the start codons, or the open reading frames, highlighted. And so every time that it starts with met means that it's a potential starting point. And every time it has a stop means that it's a potential, you know, stop point. Or the translational stop at that point. And so you can have very short open reading frames that are probably not meaningful. You can have very long open reading frames. And you can have mixtures of the two. And so this is nice that it highlights it all for you. If you're really annoyed, you know, because the inconsistency here is that the mets are shown as three characters and everything else is one character, you can change that in the options. So here it gives you the compact translation. Once again, everything is nice and pink if it's an open reading frame, but it's no longer trying to do the mets as three character codes. You know, yesterday we already talked about the NCBI databases. Those will rear their heads a few more times during this workshop, but you know, all of the sequence databases, you recall we looked at the gene database, that has information on DNA and RNA in there too. Reference sequences for DNA usually start with NM, and so if you're interested in what the reference sequence of a particular gene is, you can search for that and use that. The PDB also houses structures of DNA and RNA. Those structures of the Dickerson dodecamer for A form, B form, and Z form were all taken out of the DNA or the PDB. So even though it's the protein data bank, it now has plenty of RNA and DNA structures in there as well. Okay, so we're going to look again at this tomorrow in the bioinformatics session, but I do think it's a very useful tool where you can access a lot of these tools in one place. And so if you know, you think about some homework for tonight, you know, it's very easy to create an account on this website. It's free. They've never sent me any spam. I've never had any worries about the security. I mean, I don't give them like the same password I use for my bank account. But, you know, I don't worry about them, you know, like getting hacked into and revealing my private DNA sequences to the world. And so that's not a problem. But you can create a free account. Gosh, I forget what my account name is. I probably need to figure this out myself. It might be interesting. It's been a while since I've used it. But, oh, look at there. It's just Nfitsky. That's cool. And so when you use it, you know, there's all sorts of tools that you can do. So session tools, protein tools, nucleic acid tools, alignment tools. Most of the time I'd use either nucleic acid tools or protein tools. But if you click nucleic acid tools, you know, all of the sequences I've ever entered in my life, well, maybe not all of them. This is just for one session. But you can see there's lots of nucleic acid tools here. I can do things like, for example, if I select, I don't know what I'm working on here. So let's try, this is probably reasonable. So this is a full length DNA. If I select that particular sequence and give it a checkbox, which disappeared. There we go. So there's a checkbox there. I scroll down. I look at all these tools. There's a tool here called SixFrame. If I can find it, yep, SixFrame. I click on SixFrame, and again, it asks me some information, what translation table I want to use. If I know I only need to do the first three frames, it doesn't bother calculating the reverse three, so I can select that. I hit submit. And here's my 6-frame translation. And so you can see there's frame 1, there's frame 2, there's frame 3. It also finds the longest open reading frame. And then each of those has a little checkbox where I can go and then re-import that in as now not a DNA sequence, but a protein sequence. And then I can use all the protein tools to do the characterization if I want to. So you can see it's maybe not as quite as quick as just going to the 6-frame website, pasting in a sequence, and hitting go, but it offers some more features that can be slightly more powerful. And like I said, we'll come back tomorrow and look a little bit about this during the bioinformatics tool session, but it's good to know about, and it's been around for forever. So, I was using this as an undergrad, so I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon, so that's nice. Okay, so here's an opportunity. I think we'll take a quick break here. Think and talk with your neighbor. Is there anything that you could use this for that you think might be practically helpful? Is there anything that you would like to see that maybe we haven't talked about, but could be a useful tool? So take a couple minutes. Let's talk, and then we'll answer that in a second. Okay, I'm sensing quiet. So what do you guys think of? Anything?
It does make it easier if you don't have to do reverse complements by hand. It saves a lot of time and human error. And also just the other day in the lab, I used the DNA translation tool, the X. Mm-hmm. So, we're trying to figure out the sequence for a GFP, so we could also use XPASI to get the isoelectric points, so we use the 6 open reading frames, so it's just easy to like I said, it's there's less errors to be made if you have something like that to guide you along the way. It cuts down on time as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Plot twist. It didn't stick to the column.
Well, that was for different reasons.
Well, yeah, you can't control the physical problems of the lab. The computational side of things, though, that's hopefully manageable. Okay, so this final section, we're going to talk about DNA melting, a little bit about PCR, and some site-directed mutagenesis. And so this is sort of the core of what probably can be very helpful. Obviously, we talk about DNA strands coming together and forming Watson Crick base pairing, but clearly they can separate, too. I mean, hydrogen bonds are they're not the same as covalent bonds, and then you can reverse them. And this interaction is under some kind of thermodynamic equilibrium. And so it would be really lovely if we could take a sequence and calculate how much energy is either released or required to separate two DNA strands or to bring them together. We can think about this in terms of our physical chemistry, our gen chem, p-chem types of approach, but the fact of the matter is we have to get to a point where we need to be able to come up with an actual melting temperature based on the sequence. And so this has been done for a long time, even back before people really knew what the structure of DNA was, they could heat it up And they could see that the properties would change to a certain extent. And in particular, you know, some of those extinction coefficients we've talked about really only apply, you know, like you could see the double-stranded versus the single-stranded DNA extinction coefficients were different. And so you can't assume, you know, unlike proteins, where, you know, whether the protein is folded or misfolded or totally random, the extinction coefficient is largely the same. For DNA, because of this, the stacking of chromophores and a property called hypochromicity, you know, the DNA extinction coefficient is going to change whether it's double-stranded in a double helix versus disordered in a single strand. And so we can use that fact and do all sorts of measurements of different DNA sequences and measure melting temperatures and try to back calculate what the melting temperature is given a specific sequence. And so there's some nice rigorous thermodynamics involved here, but there's also some really nice experimental work that you have to do. You know, what's a good sequence if I'm trying to determine the contribution, for example, of a single base pair to a melting temperature? And so things that will generally affect a melting temperature, obviously if you have a longer sequence that's hybridized or complementary, it's going to have a higher energy input requirement to get those two to come apart. The salt concentration, right? Electrostatic repulsion, remember, the backbone of a DNA is charged. And so already there's a propensity for these things to repel each other electrostatically. But if I add salt, that salt works to screen that electrostatic repulsion, and that'll help make the DNA more stable. And so if I take salt away, the charges feel the full force of electrostatic repulsion. If I add salt to the system, the charges are screened to a certain extent. And then also things like whether it's a G or a C versus an A or a T. You know, GC has 3 hydrogen bonds to break and AT only has 2. And so some of the early predictions, the very early predictions for melting temperature, were very formulaic. And so this one was, it, you know, it's rough, it's not terribly accurate, but it gives you a number. And so you could say, well, add about 4 degrees Celsius for every GC pair and 2 degrees for every AT pair. And if you have 7 or 8 or 15 or 20 base pairs, you can just do that math and estimate what the melting temperature will be. And it's usually somewhere in the 50s to 70s, depending on the length of the sequence. And, you know, here's an example of, you know, I don't know how many bases, I guess 21 bases, where we use this equation, and we can estimate a melting temperature of about 70 degrees C. Not terribly accurate. I probably wouldn't rely on my PCR on that. But if I was thinking about, well, what temperature do I need to accomplish to absolutely make sure that these two things aren't hybridized, I might add 10 degrees to that and say, okay, that's probably going to be a pretty good estimate. But a better way to do it is to use the Oligo Analyzer, again, from the IDT website. And so what you, again, need is a DNA sequence of interest. And so you can paste, you know, I think that's still on my clipboard. Let's not do the whole thing. Let's just do something that would be reasonable for a primer. So about 30 bases would be probably fine. The add to order button is classic here. But what you can do is you can put that in. You can say, okay, is this RNA or DNA, obviously. What concentration are you working at? Because again, if it's high concentration, well, that's, you know, the Le Chatelier's principle. That's going to favor hybridization. If it's low concentration, it's going to favor separation. Sodium concentration and magnesium concentration, again, those are salts, so they're going to help contribute to screening. And, you know, once I put that information in, and again, you might know from either a PCR reaction mixture or some kind of protocol that's been established in your lab, you can go in and hit analyze, and it might take a second or two. But here it gives you the GC content, an approximate melting temperature, whereas this is actually using some real experimental data to inform this. A molecular weight, which is sometimes nice to have, gives you an extinction coefficient at 260. So in some sense, this supersedes or replaces the extinction coefficient calculator that we showed you earlier. And you can say, okay, well, that's going to give me my approximate melting temperature for that. And so remember, again, what is the melting temperature? It's the temperature at which 50% of your DNA is hybridized, right? So, if I go to 61 degrees, I would expect half of my DNA molecules to be hybridized or complementary, and half of those DNA molecules to be single-stranded. And so if I really want to push the point where everything is fully single-stranded, I would probably want to go at least 5 degrees up from this. And we'll see that, and well, you guys will probably see it if you ever have to do PCR. PCR is not an exact science, and so oftentimes you're playing with things like temperature to try to optimize the conditions. And part of that is from the fact that some of these numbers aren't, they're calculated, they're not precisely known. And some of it's the fact that you want to reach the appropriate composition of hybridized versus not hybridized. Another thing that occasionally comes up in PCR primer design is my protein able to come back on itself and hybridize? And sometimes you can just look at your sequence and say, that's not going to come back and form any kind of self-complementary chain. But remember, DNA can form hairpins as well. And so if you design your structure and you have a situation where some kind of weird secondary structure can form, that can complicate how your PCR primers are behaving when you're expecting them to just be, floating out in the solution. And so the easiest way to do this is to use something called the M-fold server, which is a nice check to do. It doesn't take very long. You can go in, and we're going to do the RNA folding form because on your web, on the slides, I think the next slide example I have. It gives the transactivation response element from HIV. And so this is a way that HIV recognizes some of its own RNA and helps it to package itself better. And so this is RNA sequence, and we're going to try folding this in real time. It doesn't take a lot of computational resources to, try to predict what the folded structure is. And so all we need to do is put that in, hit Control V, and we enter the sequence name. We'll just call this HIV TAR. If you look down here, there's constraints that you can put in. So for example, if you know that two bases are complexed, or perhaps you've done some kind of chemical modification to cause two bases to be covalently attached, you can put restraints like that in. There's other types of things that you can put in, like what temperature are you thinking about doing this at? I think there's some settings for salt concentration and stuff like that here as well. You can read about that, but as a quick assessment, this is just a very easy way to sort of predict what's going to happen. And so when we hit scroll all the way to the bottom and we hit fold, I think it'll take a minute or two. Not even. And what we can do is we can open up, there's energetic plots, but the plot that you're probably most interested in are the structure files. And so you can just download these either as a PDF or a PNG. And it'll give you multiple structures if it thinks it can calculate multiple valid structures. But here, you can see it basically identifies that this thing can come back and form a hairpin on itself. And indeed, the proteins that recognize and package the HIV you know, viral particle are relying on this protein to have, or this DNA or RNA sequence to have a particular structure. And so this is sort of how you can figure out what that structure might be. And again, just looking at the sequence, maybe you're keen enough that you can come in and say, oh yeah, no, that looks like it complements with that. But because of the way that reverse complementation works, you know, it's not often obvious, at least unless you've been doing this a lot. So you can go in and use this as a way of sort of figuring out whether your RNA, or you know, you can use it for DNA primers as well, form any kind of persistent or stable secondary structure. So why is this useful? Well, I've alluded several times now to PCR. I don't have time, you know, maybe if we split this up into two, I could go into what PCR is. But, you know, Carrie Mullis and Michael Smith were the two that sort of came up with PCR. And basically, it's a way to amplify particular genes. And so you have a primer at one end, a primer at the other end, and you can basically take advantage of molecular biology to synthesize a DNA sequence in its own reverse complement, and now you can amplify that gene and then use that gene later on. So you can, you know, clone it into a plasmid vector like we talked about earlier. You can use it for forensic analysis to try to identify DNA or genetic features from trace amounts of DNA. Very important technique, but it starts with designing good primers. And one of the features that you guys will be thinking about is, suppose I have an already existing plasmid that expresses a particular protein. So I have a protein of interest. Maybe it's a G protein coupled receptor or a fluorescent protein or something like that. And you want to introduce a mutation. So you want to change, you know, the fourth alanine to, you know, threonine. You know, you basically do that by designing primers that hybridize to your original plasmid, and then as those primers are synthesized by the DNA polymerase, they incorporate the mutagenic codon into the new plasmids that are made, and at the end of the day, now you have some new plasmids that contain the site change or the mutagenesis that you wanted to incorporate. And so, you know, part of that is figuring out what the appropriate temperatures and things like that, and how long your primer should be. But for most purposes, we generally use this Agilent website, Quick Change Primer Design Kit. And there's some very easy tools for introducing a particular mutation into a known protein sequence. And so we're going to work through this in the last, you know, 7 minutes or so that we have. And hopefully this will get you a feeling for how you might design some actual primers. And so again, on the website, we have some DNA sequences. And so here is a protein that we've worked on in the lab called Dark NSH3. It's a fairly small domain, 59 residues, but it's partially folded. And it turns out that one mutant, or changing one threonine to glycine, causes this protein to go from partially folded to fully folded. And so we're going to see what we can do as far as incorporating this T22G variant into this DNA sequence. And so I have the protein sequence up here, but to save time, I've also included the DNA sequence here. And so what we're going to do is we're going to go to the Agilent website. So I'm going to copy and paste that guy. Oops. I guess I got to copy and paste this first. Yeah, maybe it doesn't work. There we we go. Okay, so, and it's nice now, they used to make you log in. But what we're going to do is we're going to paste our DNA sequence there. Oops. I'm going to hit upload translated because that'll make it a little easier, I think. Oops, or not. Okay, so paste DNA, hit upload translated. And so you'll see what that does is it basically translates that into the protein sequence. And that's convenient for us because now we don't have to go back to our genetic table or our codon table and keep switching back and forth, right? And so I can go here to threonine 22. And there's options here. I mean, you can have it delete sequence or delete sections of sequence. But it's most straightforward to do one or two base pair changes. You know, I've inserted as much as I think 10 residues using quick change before, but you're not guaranteed that it, you know, the harder you make it for the polymerase to do a round of PCR, the less likely that you're going to get results. And so I want to change threonine 22, and that's the first site. So now I'm going to go here and select glycine. And again, that represents the T22 variant. I don't like to call it a T22 mutant because mutant typically means DNA, whereas changes in bases are usually variants. And so that's the only change I need to make. And the designer program is going to basically take care of all the DNA sequencing. How long does the primer need to be to have the appropriate melting temperature for a typical site-directed mutagenesis run? And again, if you have the instructions or if you download the quick change instructions online, they sort of recommend, here's the temperature that you should run for the annealing, here's the temperature that you should run for extension. So they give you some temperatures and some basic ideas for what you should actually be doing in the lab. Change. I guess I gotta follow the instructions. Change 22 to glycine. And now I hit design primers. And at the bottom, it gives me the two primers that it recommends. One in the sense direction going, you know, 5 prime, 3 prime. The other in the anti-sense going, you know, 3 prime, 5 prime if you read it that way. It gives me the sequences both in order from 5 prime to 3 prime. It gives me the length. It gives me the approximate melting temperature. And again, it shows me where the mismatches will occur. And so to change T to G, in a single step, I have to change two bases. I can't just change one. Now, again, if this doesn't work, then what I might do is I might change one of the bases in one round of PCR and then another base in another round of PCR. But oftentimes you can get by changing two and sometimes even three bases at a time for those real hard cases where you've got, you know, totally different codons. But in this case, I only need to change two. So you can see I'm basically changing a GG to a CG, or I guess technically an AC, here's my primer, the 5 prime, 3 prime end. So it's changing AC to GG, right? Because the normal sequence is going to be AC, and my new primer in the 5 prime, 3 direction is GG. And so I can then take these primers and then, you know, send them off to Midland or IDT or any number of other primer synthesis, you know, oligo synthesis companies, and then they'll send me those primers and I can use them in my PCR. Now, obviously, we can't do the PCR in class. That usually takes at least, 4 or 5 hours plus, transformation plus all that other stuff. But what we can do is we can look at our file again and we can see if we have the right thing. So typically what you can do is you can send off your plasmids to be sequenced and then the company will send back the sequence that it reads out. Usually that's called Sanger sequencing or single sample sequencing. And so here is a result that we can now use, and we can go try out our six-frame tool. And so this was an actual result when we did this. We can use that, or we can use XBASY. So this is an actual result where we did this mutagenesis in the lab. And if I search here, now a couple of things you'll notice, and again, we're not doing a class on how sequencing works, but you'll see there's a couple of cases in here where there's ends. And generally that means that in the sequencing result, there wasn't a very good read, and it didn't quite know how to call the particular base. And so typically what I do is I will go through and I will look for ends, and I'll try to find the last end so that I'm not trying to translate something that may not be translatable. Okay, so there was a big jump between this end and the next end. So let me find the next one. All right, so here the next one is all the way down here. And so you can go in and try to translate that. But keep in mind, one single N could mean a base, a single base was missed. It could mean a double base was missed. It could be that there's no base there at all. And so it might screw up the six-frame alignment that you're looking at in the translation tool. And so I usually just try to get rid of them all together. And if I find that the sequence that I'm left with isn't enough to confirm the sequence, then I'll go back and maybe take a closer look at some of those ends, or even just download the raw data from the sequencing facility. Okay, so now we got the frames. And I know for a fact that it's in frame 2. But we can look at our original sequence. So what we have here in the DNA sequence is it starts with MET, glutamic acid, alanine, isoleucine, so M-E-A-I-A. And if I look here, you can see M-E-A-I-A. And eventually you scroll through, and if we look at the region that we're interested in, so the T22G region, so that's going to be right here. So it's surrounded by RK. So I should see an RKGQI. And sure enough, RKGQI. So I've confirmed that the mutagenesis looks good. Tomorrow during the bioinformatics session, we'll talk a little bit about sequence alignment, how you can find some tools that make it a little easier for this. But for a 59 base sequence, back in the early days, I just put them both into Microsoft Word and compared one line to the next, and that worked just well enough. So that's good enough for this case, and it sort of shows you how some of these tools can be very useful for doing some basic PCR and confirmation of the sequence. Okay, so we've covered that. Generally speaking, if you're designing general DNA plasmid primers or PCR primers, you can still go back to this approach. Often you're thinking about what temperature do I need to anneal and what temperature do I need to extend. And so annealing, you want your primer to come back on to the sequence, and so that you want that to be low, be below the melting temperature. And similarly with extension, you want that to be high enough that your polymerase can can make your DNA, but not so high that your DNA is basically melting. And so that's where the temperature can come in. There's some general strategies here, but I'm not going to belabor this. You can look at these rules and sort of figure out on your own what might be a good approach. And you know, there's a useful tool here for thinking about hybridization. And so here's a case where you can upload a primer and you can think about, you know, oh, well, I want to change, you know, these two bases so that they're no longer complementary, and it can still calculate what the temperature is. Otherwise, you're going back all the way to that, you know, 2 degrees for T's and 4 degrees for G's. And so this approach, you know, the thermodynamics and hybridization tool is a nice way to say, okay, how can I calculate some actual temperatures, given that there will be some mismatch? Okay, so we've run over. I was expecting to run over. I'm not going to do the think and discuss. You know, there's all sorts of problems that can arise. But we went through this, you know, example, and hopefully that gives you a feeling for how you might do this in the actual, maybe not the lab, but in the pre-lab, so to speak. Questions? Okay, I know we're moving at quite a clip. That was sort of the most dense session that we have. But we'll take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back and we'll talk about Pymol and the PDB.